Heath Witter has served as curator of history in Mackinac Island State Park Commission for over 25 years. He has written extensively on the history of the Western Great Lakes and is author of Battle for the Soul, Métis Children Encounter Evangelical Protestants at Mackinac Mission, 1823 to 1837. Mr. Witter's history of MSU's first 70 years, Michigan Agricultural College, The Evolution of a Land-Grant Philosophy, 1855 to 1925, won the Historical Society of Michigan's 2005 State History Award and was chosen as a Michigan Notable Book by the Library of Michigan. This is the first of a three-volume set that will be published during the Michigan State University sesquicentennial beginning in 2005. Keith will read for about 45 or 50 minutes and also discuss his book, and then afterwards will be available for questions from the audience. As you'll see, there are also Keith's books up here for sale, and he'd also be happy to sign them for you. So will you please join me in welcoming Keith Witter.
Thank you, Peter. It's a real pleasure to be here tonight and to be part of this series. Tonight I'm going to do some things a little different than I've done in other talks relative to this book. I'm going to want to share a few minutes talking about sort of the journey, my journey as a historian that got me to write this volume, because in many ways I would never have dreamed that this would be a project that I would be working on. And then I would spend just a few minutes talking about give a brief introduction as to the establishment of Michigan Agricultural College or Michigan State University, and then spend the remainder of my time talking about and reading some things from the book, which will be primarily quotations from people of the time, faculty and students, to articulate some of the issues and the themes that I talk about and develop in the book. I came to this project as a historian, trained as a historian, so as a student and as a teacher. And as Peter mentioned, I had worked for over 25 years as a historian with Mackinac State Park Commission. And that really meant that my primary interest in historical things and research areas were dealt with history that dealt with, or focused at least on, or centered on, the Straits of Mackinac. And most folks who have visited Mackinac, I'm sure most of you here have a hard time sometimes seeing beyond the shores of the island or seeing beyond the shore of the mainland where Michilimackinac is. But yet the reality is that Mackinac is the center of a very large region. It's a cultural center, also was a commercial center, military center for many years. And I've often said that in some very real ways, each day that goes on, the historical significance of Mackinac gets less. And the people I worked for didn't like me to say that, but it really was true. And that doesn't mean that it was any less important. And my first visit to Mackinac Island was in 1966. I was working as a research assistant with David Armour, who was a professor of history at University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, where I was a student. And Dave was working up at Mackinac in the summers and ultimately become the deputy director, and I would finally go work for him up at Mackinac on a full-time basis. But on the first visit to Mackinac Island, we took a walk down to the southeast corner of the island, and there's a couple of very striking buildings. The Mission Church is the one that catches your eye, and here is this magnificent New England meeting house out here in the middle of Michigan, built in 1829. And just up the hill a little ways is the Mission House, which is still extant. At that time was used sort of as storage, and now is used as summer housing for state park employees. But these places really captivated my attention. I was wondering, boy, what is the story of these buildings? Certainly this was a 19th century frontier experience here. And in Mackinac, it's somewhat easier to envision a 19th century experience because of the way the place is laid out. It's still, the streets are laid out as they were 150, 200 years ago, and many 19th century buildings. And the missionaries who came to, who built the church and the mission house, according to the historical marker, were Presbyterians and Congregationalists who were adherents of Reformed Protestant theology. And I said, well, this is my faith. So, question. What happened when proselytizing missionaries entered a society that revolved around the fur trade? Two worldviews that are very, very different. And so as a result, I began researching this topic even before I went to work for the Park Commission on a full-time basis. And after I started working for the park, I continued researching it, even though it was not something that was very high on their list of topics to do. And so eventually this topic became the subject of my dissertation and what I ultimately published as Battle for the Soul. And the dissertation, though, became much more than a study of religion, but also became a study of education and of a school. This was a school that existed for only 14 years. It was a boarding school. Most of in fact, all the students who came to the mission, almost all of them, were children who had French-Canadian or American fathers and Native American mothers, Métis, who were multicultural students. The school had a very specific purpose. That was to convert children to Protestant, evangelical Protestant Christianity, and to convert adults from the world in which they came from. It also was to teach children biblical truths, but more than that, it was important in this school to teach children the English language. Most of the kids who came, this English was not a language they knew. For most boys, French was their first language. For most girls, it was either Chippewa or Odawa. The missionaries also were intent on teaching these children academic skills that they would need to know in order to survive in the American society that was emerging and growing in the first half of the 19th century. Reading, writing, speaking, arithmetic, geography. And the school also was very intent on teaching practical skills that for girls to learn how to become effective or like New England homemakers, and boys to learn how to farm. And for boys, this was going to be a real stretch because they came from a culture where women did the agricultural work. And in order to understand the world and the story of the missions, it was important for me to try to create and get a sense of the larger community in which this mission was set, not only in Mackinac, but the regional environment, as well as the national environment. I say that as this rather windy introduction because as I was thinking about what to say tonight, I realized in some ways, for the first time, in some ways maybe reminded, how important this experience, this work was in shaping how I approached the Michigan Agricultural History Project. How did I come to get involved in this? Writing this early history of Michigan State, which I will usually refer to as Michigan Agricultural College. Well, I grew up on a farm, a dairy farm in Wisconsin. And one of the things I tell people, and I mean this, is probably the most important thing in life for the first 18 years of my life was to figure out how do I get off this farm. Especially a dairy farm. Anyone who's ever been affected, anything to do with the dairy farm, you know that you work for the cows. But I always retained an interest in things agricultural. I always feel at home if I go back to Wisconsin and happen to visit a farm that a relative or someone else might have, or I like driving through the country, I'm interested in what's going on in the fields and the like. And so the idea of doing a history of the agricultural college was something that appealed to me. Although I never would have dreamed of attending one. Having lived in East Lansing now for about 30 years, or a little over 30 years, I've always been, was always fascinated by the fact that the MSU administration and others referred to this as a land-grant university. And that was fairly easy to grasp because the land-grant universities really were the result of the Morrell Act. But then there was this thing that was often referred to as the land-grant philosophy. And what did that mean? And it's pretty hard to find a definition of land-grant philosophy, in part because it's very hard to do. And I was interested in it. What does land-grant philosophy, as a philosophy of education, really mean? I also was impressed by the fact that this university seems to really value its early history, which sometimes I get the impression that colleges and universities are very eager to forget some of their early beginnings. When they change their name to university, they forget that they once were a college or something of a name that doesn't have quite as much prestige. Here, it always seemed to me that the Michigan Agricultural College, as a name for the institution, still had meaning and was valued. And then to walk down in downtown East Lansing and see the Avenue, capital M, period, capital A, period, capital C, period, M-A-C, not Mac Avenue, but M-A-C. What did that mean? There was something about that. I happened to be working at the press after I retired from the Park Commission at the MSU Press when the accessory centennial project that Peter was referring to came into being, came online. And I expressed one day to Fred Bohm, the director, that I might be interested in writing the first volume. And he said, well, write me a letter of application, and which I did, and I wound up being selected to do the project. I also, as I was thinking about what to say tonight, realized that having done this project here on the Mackinac Mission School, I really had an interest in how formal or institutional education changed individuals' lives, how it changed people's lives, and also how a formal and institutional institution of learning changes society, and what were areas where it didn't bring about change or transformation. For example, in the mission story, you'd find that the missionaries were really very successful on Mackinac Island in temperance and getting people, even people who weren't converted, to think about how much alcohol ought to be consumed. Alcohol abuse was a big problem in the fur trade society. The result of the missionaries' work helped to reduce that some. The observance of Sunday as a Sabbath. There was a lot less activity, commercial activity, going on in the late 1820s and early 1830s on Mackinac Island because of the effect of the missions. Other areas where they had really had no effect at all, and perhaps even probably reinforced what were very strong prejudices against Native people held by New Englanders and against particularly the Métis people who were referred to in a derogatory sense as half-breeds. And so there was very little change there, if any, and as would argue, probably even hardened the attitudes. So I was interested in studying MAC, what kinds of answers would I find relative to these questions? How did being educated here bring about changes in individual lives, and how did what was going on at this institution help to bring about changes in society? A few words about the beginnings of the college and its origins and its early history, and then I'm going to move on and sort of let some of the people who made the history of the college speak. Michigan adopted a new state constitution in 1850, and there had been a lot of agitation for the wanting to create an agricultural college in Michigan. The idea of agricultural education was really an idea that was being advocated by a large number of people across the country in agricultural societies. There were people were looking to Europe where there was a lot of research going on, and particularly in agricultural chemistry and sort of a growth of science. And people were saying, hey, we have institutions of higher learning to teach ministers and to teach professors, but we don't have anything for agriculture. And so there was this what was going on. So the Michigan Constitution that was adopted in 1850 faced this issue right on. They said, yes, we need an agricultural college, but they said it could either be a department at the University of Michigan or a separate institution. And so the issue really was not resolved. And so for 5 years, there was a very intense battle waged throughout the state as to whether or not this College of Agriculture should be a separate institution or a part of the university. Arguments for making it a department university, put forth primarily by President Henry Tappan, said, well, we already have an institution. We have a faculty. We have laboratories. We have buildings. Those who were in favor of a separate institution, of whom John C. Holmes led the way, said, yeah, but if this becomes a department in the university, it's not going to get the kind of emphasis it needs. It's just going to become another department. And we need to have people who understand farming and know agriculture who will put together this institution and staff it. Holmes and the separate institution forces won in 1855. In February of 1855, Governor Bingham, on Abraham Lincoln's birthday, although at that time Abraham Lincoln's birthday was only significant to Abraham Lincoln, he signed a bill which created and established the Agricultural College of the State of Michigan. 2 years later, or 2 years and 3 months later, three buildings had been constructed, faculty housing was under construction, and the first students came to this college. And it began what was really what Alonzo Sessions, who was a state representative from Ionia County, called an experiment wholly new and untried in this country. And this was new. There were no precedents. You could not go to any other place and look and see what an agricultural college should look like. In fact, in some of the early correspondence, when you look at Joseph Williams' papers, the first president of the college, it's amazing how many letters are there where people are writing in wanting to know about how are you doing this? What advice do you have for us? We'd like to establish an agricultural college in Kentucky or Mississippi or Vermont or Wisconsin. And so this place was known and people were aware of what was going on. And so it was a whole new approach to higher education. And Alonzo Sessions had it exactly right that this was truly an experiment. After about 2 years, Williams retired, caught up in some politics, and the college was really left sort of leaderless. Lewis R. Fisk succeeded him as president pro tem, and the college was, when it was established, was put under the State Board of Education. The State Board of Education also had under its jurisdiction the Normal School, which is today Eastern Michigan University, Ypsilanti, which had opened its doors, I think, in 1852. And the State Board of Education really had little concept of what this agricultural college was supposed to be. And Gregory proposed that rather than having a four-year curriculum, it should be a two-year curriculum. And one of the geniuses of the four-year curriculum was that it not only called for the teaching of sciences and subject matter that was going to be significant for agriculture, but it would also have an English course, that students be taught English, learning how to read, write, and speak English, be taught some history, philosophy, courses that we call the liberal arts. Gregory proposed doing away with those and having what really amounted to a two-year curriculum, basically a technical curriculum. Well, Fisk and the students here and the faculty were not pleased. And I'm going to read a paragraph that describes this. Professor Lewis R. Fisk, who served as president pro tem after Williams' exit, championed the four-year curriculum. His report to the newly formed State Board of Agriculture, dated 4 April 1861, is a remarkable document. He spent many pages informing the board of the condition of the institution that they now govern, and I'll tell you about how that board came into being in a minute. When Fisk gets to the, quote, course of study, quote, section, he quotes extensively from his 1859 report to the State Board of Education. It is here that we see the crux of the argument for a four-year program. Fisk reaffirms his commitment to the principle that, quote, this institution should be built upon an agricultural basis, that no department of practical farming should be left unexplained. It should be a place where science and practice shall be beautifully combined. But he did not stop here when he continued on to say, quote, the only way to teach agriculture here is to teach literature also. A very strong statement that the education here was to be much more than to teach practical farmers. Going on, Fisk stated emphatically that the faculty supported this position and added that they believed that a four-year, quote, comprehensive course of instruction, end quote, was essential, if for no other reason than because the students demanded it. T.C. Abbott recorded the student sentiment in his journal, March, quote, March 1, 1860. We met students and told them that we should organize the old academic studies for those who wished, the purely agriculture for those who wished. All voted for the academic. end quote. The battle for a four-year comprehensive academic and agricultural course of study united the students and the faculty. And I would argue that one of the things that was be distinctive or helped to distinguish the land-grant philosophy that took shape over the next 40 or 50, 60 years was that students and faculty and administration all really participated in shaping this, and they defined what would become the land-grant way or the land-grant philosophy, often in the face of much opposition in the public, and that it was through vision and strength of character on the part of the faculty and administrators and the students who really had a much better sense of what was needed, that their persistence really led to the assurance that this institution would be successful. 1862, Congress passed the Morrell Act, or was often called the Land-Grant College Act, which I would argue is one of the most significant pieces of legislation the United States Congress has ever passed. And given what goes on in Washington these days, I wish our congressmen and senators would take a look at a piece of legislation like this and get an idea of what good law is really all about. This particular act, I want to read one quote from it, which what it really did, the Morrell Act set aside grants of land for each state, which were based on the number of representatives they have in Congress. These lands were then sold, which created an endowment which the states could draw upon to support what were the land-grant colleges. Part of the genius of this legislation was that none of these funds could be used for construction. So it required that the states make a commitment. But yet there was a lot of latitude for states. You know, each state's experience in land-grant will be somewhat different. But here's a critical portion of Section 4 of this Act. To the endowment, support, and maintenance of at least one college, that's what the funds are to be used for, where the leading object shall be, without excluding other scientific and classical studies, and including military tactics, to teach such branches of learning as are related to agriculture and the mechanic arts. And I want to emphasize mechanic arts. That'll be important in just a few minutes. In such manner as the legislatures of the states may respectively prescribe, in order to promote the liberal and practical education of the industrial classes in the several pursuits and professions of life. A wonderful statement of what the purpose of these colleges were to be for the industrial students of the industrial classes. And so these were not to be schools for the elites. And these were schools for really where there was to be no limitation, you know, on what could be studied. But they were to teach agriculture and the mechanic arts and military tactics. As I was thinking through the book really winds up having basically three themes. And these themes then articulate the meaning of the land-grant philosophy. And one of the underlying notions that goes through all of this is that the land-grant philosophy was revolutionary. This quote from the Morrell Act is really a revolutionary statement as to what higher education, what higher education can look like and who it can be for. And one of the reasons it was so, it's been so successful was there was room and a need for it. There's nothing in the Morrell Act that was against the existing colleges and universities that were rooted in the classics. This was really meeting a need of a need that was out there. Anyhow, my three basic themes are, first, the conflict between the Michigan Agricultural College and many Michigan farmers over the role of the college generated creative tension that shaped the land-grant philosophy at MAC. One of the things I learned was that the very class of people, a group of people for whom the college was supposedly created to benefit the most, were some of its strongest opponents. And this lasted throughout for the first 60 years. And I'll get into one very bitter controversy in just a minute. The second theme is the students, the sons and daughters of Justin Morrell's, quote, industrial classes, helped to shape the college's curriculum, as we saw in 1861, and fulfilled the mission of the land-grant education through their work in the wider world they entered after they left the institution. I just realized I forgot to mention one piece of that 1860-61 controversy was that In 1861, the Michigan State Legislature passed the Reorganization Act for the college and created the State Board of Agriculture, which is the forerunner of today's Board of Trustees. And the State Board of Agriculture's primary job was to oversee the agricultural college, and that made a world of difference. And that act, that Reorganization Act, put into law in no uncertain terms the college was to offer an English course as well as an agricultural course. It really put into law the fact that this was to be have a comprehensive curriculum. The third theme that I argue in the book is that the land-grant philosophy that evolved at Michigan Agricultural College expanded and strengthened American democracy. And in the time that I have left, I really like to go over, look at several what I will call vignettes. I read some portions from the book and comment on them. And also in these quotations will be some quotations taken from students and faculty presidents of the college. Beginning around 1912 and lasting at least through 1914, was a very bitter controversy over the teaching of engineering at Michigan Agricultural College. Many farmers really from the beginning of the college, were always very critical of this institution. And they were critical of the institution because they said, you're not teaching enough practical farming. You're not educating enough practical farmers. Our sons are going to your school and they aren't coming back to our farm. And the farmers didn't like that. And even the Michigan State Grange, which is one of the best friends this college had ever had, was critical in its publications that you guys got to be educating more practical farmers. No one ever really defined what a practical farmer was, however. But so this was a source of bitter conflict. And it came to a head, 1912, 1913, 1914, over the teaching of engineering, which really was what mechanic arts had evolved into. And the crisis arose because the legislature in 1912 passed a budget that said Michigan Agricultural College can only expend $35,000 for the teaching of engineering. Well, this was woefully inadequate. The college challenged this piece of legislation in the Michigan State Supreme Court. When the college had expended the $35,000, the Auditor General of the State of Michigan said, okay, no more money. And so for a while, things were pretty tight. Meanwhile, everyone was waiting for the state Supreme Court to render a decision. When they rendered their decision, they found in favor of the college. And in many ways, the decision, as I understand it, really revolved around the authority of the legislature to tell the college how to expend the federal monies that came from the land-grant endowment. And the Supreme Court said that the legislature did not have control over those funds. But that did not necessarily end the controversy. And Adrian, which is a real center of agriculture, there were people in Adrian who weren't particularly happy with this state of affairs. And so I'm going to read a column, an editorial that appeared in 1814. In response to this episode, which I just described, the Adrian Daily Telegram published a scathing editorial denouncing MAC for teaching engineering. The editorial oozes with frustration, bitterness, and anger over what is perceived to be the intent of the college to entice students to leave the farm for other professions. Okay, now I'm going to read this quote slowly because there's a lot in it, and it really is filled with a lot of emotion. And remember, this is 1914, 59 years after the college was established and 57 years after it had opened its doors. Quote, in one sense, this effort is unfair. It is almost underhanded because the MAC uses the name of, quote, agriculture, end quote, and the prestige of the state, quote, agricultural, end quote, college to induce farmers' boys to quit the farm. Unquestionably, the fact that the engineering school is attached to the agricultural college results in many boys leaving the farm forever, who otherwise would have become farmers of the most practical type. Even when a boy goes to East Lansing to study farming, he is immediately subjected to temptation to become an engineer. This is not because engineering is better than farming, but because it is novel and interesting, and many boys are fascinated by machinery and scientific experiments. We cannot imagine a more effective, quote, away from the farm, end quote, influence than an engineering school masquerading as an agricultural college. And so this, you know, and there had been other editorials and comments in Michigan papers saying, you know, boy, we got to control things that are going on at the college. So this was a very deep rift. Ultimately, this gets resolved with an engineering building burns and Ransom E. Olds next year. And Ransom E. Olds comes to the rescue with a $100,000 donation to build what we now call Olds Hall. And so you can read about it in the book if you want to learn more about it. But again, sometimes one of the most refreshing things about a study like this is how well the students understood things, far better often than certainly the editorial writer at the Adrian Daily Telegram. I'm going to read a paragraph here where the students sort of take this controversy and tie together these competing issues. For a final word relative to tension between agriculture and engineering, we turn to a student analysis to give clarity to what appeared to many to be contradictions between teaching agriculture and engineering, and the practical and the theoretical at Michigan Agricultural College. An editorialist writing on June 9, 1913, for the student newspaper HOCAD concluded, quote, that working side by side, the engineer and the farmer have brought agriculture up to its high plane, end quote. Examples of this partnership abounded. Electricity ran small machines, and it lit farmers' houses. Gasoline engines powered tractors that allowed farmers to increase their productivity, and, quote, automobile trucks, end quote. Remember, this is a time when trucks are a new thing. To move their farm goods quickly over hard surface roads and concrete bridges. Other gasoline engines ran pumps that sent water to farm buildings or irrigation ditches fashioned by engineers. The designers of all these technological wonders had to have a theoretical knowledge of physical science and mathematics before they could create devices that had enormous practical applications on the farm or in town. Practicality grew out of the theoretical. Justin Morrill knew what was going on after all when he wrote into law the requirement that the land-grant college teach both agriculture and mechanic arts. Not all incidents that happened in the college's history were pleasant. We can look at the controversy, the engineering controversy, and see, I think, the tension that existed between the public and the college. And I think, as the students pointed out, it really created something that was pretty good, pretty neat. But not everything that happened here was something that we really like to talk about. But I'm going to share with you a very nasty incident that occurred in 1888. And I'll read. On Saturday night, in late April 1888, 8 or 10 American-born MSA students harassed 3 Japanese students, physically and verbally, and destroyed their property. Although the Japanese students resisted, they lacked the strength to overcome their attackers, who terrorized them for a couple of hours. After conducting an investigation, the faculty suspended 4 American students for 1 year, and President Edwin Willits gave a private reprimand to one of the Japanese students. All 3 Japanese students left the college. K.G. Minakata explained his reasons for dropping out of MAC. As I read this, this is a very gripping quote, a very painful quote, because here was a college that really prided itself on not really having prejudice and bias, and yet the reality proved that that really wasn't the case. I quote from what K.G. Minakata wrote to President Willits on leaving the college. quote, "But now I must go out this college because I suspect that we may not be hereafter in this college in comfortable condition. Of course, I have done everything possible in last Saturday night's case, and they have nothing to say about their punishment. Yet I fear that all the men in this college, except a few, will constantly display their worst feelings upon us, or at least some bodies will be in utmost animosity against us, for they naturally like their own countrymen further than a stranger. I am unhappily to go out, but it must be done so." And these three students left, and I think one or two maybe went to Purdue to finish their education. But here was a painful example of how hard it was to bring together people sometimes from different places. And this was not the case for all international students, however, because I want to read to you another quote that shows a person who came from Turkey who had a very different experience. Quote, "In 1906, H. Karamanian, who had come from Turkey in 1896 to attend MAC, recalled with fondness the kind treatment that he received upon his arrival during his stay at the college and its impact on him." And this is Karamanian's words. Quote, "A period of 12 years separates me from that happy time when I put myself under your," meaning President Snyder, "and Professor Clinton D. Smith's care. The first day I was on campus, I was picked up by him," meaning Smith, "and on my request was carried to his office to write a letter. On the same day I met you," referring to Snyder, "in your office, and you introduced you myself. One of the first questions you asked me was, 'How much money have you?' I answered, 5 dollars only. And you laughed heartily, since you had suggested to me to come with $50 for the first year. From that day on, with your guidance and under Professor Smith's care, I have never been misfortunate until some family misfortunes called me home on the autumn of 1897. And he'd gone home because of family problems. But when you look at that quote, one of the things that you may not have caught was that Snyder had been in correspondence with him before he came here while he was still in Turkey. And that was a very common thing. You want to apply to Michigan Agricultural College, and at this point it had about 300 students, you'd, in all likelihood, address your postcard to President Snyder. And believe me, his papers are full of them. And requesting a catalog or requesting information, and President Snyder would make sure that catalogs were sent, and in this case actually corresponded. And it would be not uncommon for him to correspond with prospective students, whether they were from the U.S. or they were from overseas. Very, very important part of the college's history. But you see, there, it's not all of it is not necessarily pleasant. Another example, I'd like to share with you a couple of quick examples of two women who were educated here in the women's program, which started in 1896. And we really see that the importance of outreach here and how when people who were educated at Michigan Agricultural College went out to where the people really were, how effective it was and how well this was received by the public. I read, Mina Girard, who attended from 1898 to 1901 but did not graduate, who had enrolled in the women's course in 1898, held a series of 10 meetings in the basement of the Presbyterian Church in Yale, Michigan, in the late summer and early autumn of 1903. A look at her work serves as a fitting conclusion to this chapter. The ladies of the church had invited Girard to share with them her knowledge of domestic science. They paid her $15 and reimbursed her for train fare to and from Lansing. Girard showed her audience how to determine the nutritional value of different foods and how to cook them without diminishing their nourishment or flavor. As word spread of her work, women from other communities came to Yale to hear this MAC-trained young woman tell them how to improve their cooking. As a result, Girard received two invitations to come to other towns to repeat her presentations. At the conclusion of the meetings, Girard explained how the agricultural college benefited the public. The Reverend Charles D. Ellis, who was pastor of the church there, commented on her effort, quote, "I can hardly imagine anything that could be done in a community that would do more to advertise and commend the college to a people than just such work as Ms. Gerard has done here." Ellis anticipated the creation of the Extension Service when he added, quote, "And perhaps her work here might be a hint as to some way of widening the influence of the college." Another example of a young woman who was an early, in this case, a graduate of the women's program, was Harriet Robeson. I'll read a paragraph here about her work. "Even before women at MAC received formal training in the craft of teaching, they gave instruction in domestic science and domestic arts in the public schools. They stressed the centrality of ordinary things in the daily life of children. Harriet Robeson, class of 1900, worked in the manual training department of the public schools in Detroit in 1901. She and her 9 colleagues gave instruction in sewing and cooking to girls and in the use of hand tools to boys in grades 5 through 8. Robeson divided her time between 9 different schools, where she found that the girls looked forward to their sewing classes. Consequently, Robeson met children from, quote, all classes and conditions of society, end quote. As she taught the daughters of the rich as well as poor German, Polish, and Jewish girls, Robeson could not help growing very cosmopolitan in sympathy. She shared with the readers of the MAC Record, which was a college newspaper at the time, in November 1901, the importance of the small things in life, as she explained why she preferred working with poorer students. Quote, she says, "Their cramped soul-starved lives explain so much, and they are so appreciative of every little kindness," end quote. She noted that it was important to compliment a little girl who was wearing a clean apron or possessed a pair of clean hands when on a tour of inspection. Clean hands in the kitchen, of course, led to a healthier family. And even that small detail needed to be recognized, valued, and taught. And this was to be another one of the characteristics of the land-grant philosophy as it evolved here, was that it paid a lot of attention to the ordinary things of everyday life, things that we often aren't even conscious of. Well, as the Reverend Ellis had pointed out, and when he was commenting on Mina Gerard's work at Yale, Michigan, that this was really effective work, and he really was foreshadowing the creation of the Cooperative Extension Service. And the Cooperative Extension came about as a result of the Smith-Lever Act in 1914. But from its beginning, the college had really struggled and had made an incredible effort, however, to connect with the people of the state of Michigan. How could they take what was being learned here and research what was being taught here and somehow get it to the people of the state so that they could use this knowledge and apply it to their lives? This was very important done with answering the mail. The amount of mail that came in here was phenomenal. People asking everything about chickens and eggs. They might send in bugs. What is this bug? They send in weeds. What is this weed? Is it a bad weed? Is it a bad bug? What do I do about it? How do I get rid of it? And the like. And the professors here, W.J. Beale, spent countless hours responding to these questions, and Frank Kedzie and A.J. Cook and the others. And this was effective, but it met only the needs of generally the people who wrote the question. The college also was busy being involved in exhibitions at state fairs, or at fairs, regional fairs, agricultural society fairs, farmers' institutes that they created, where the professors would go out into communities and team up with agricultural leaders or other leaders in the community and do a 2-day program trying to, again, to educate the public. These were effective, but the college really didn't make the real connection until Cooperative Extension came online. And the genius of the Cooperative Extension was that it placed trained agricultural agents in each county, or initially not in every county, but in counties where people lived. And there also were home demonstration agents, not as many, women who would go and live in the county who were there to help women learn how to make better meals that were more nutritious, how to sew, how to manage your household more economically, how to deal with health issues and the like. And so you had the college then had extension agents where the people were. The extension agents drew upon people who were at the college, who worked for extension, who would come and make presentations. Well, this started, the cooperative extension came into being in 1914. I think the first extension agent, really, if I remember right, was 1908 in Michigan, in other states, earlier in some other states. But when World War I broke out, there was a great, and the United States didn't get involved in the war until 1917, but part of the war effort was to encourage women to prepare meals that didn't use much sugar or fat or flour, because these were foodstuffs that were wanted by the troops and also wanting to send to Europeans who were starving. And there was a great push to try to make the farmers more productive. And so you had the agents in the field. Here were the home demonstration agents, and there were more of them because of government money. The number of agents expanded dramatically by 1917. And so you had women here to teach other women who could then teach their friends and their family how to make more effective meals and to manage the food more effectively. Agricultural agents were in the field to help farmers get better seeds, to help them learn how to use tractors and the like. And so you really had what was in place then, both a structure and trained people who could help the war effort. Well, Frank Kedzie, who was the president of the college in 1917, and Frank Kedzie grew up here. His father, Robert Kedzie, was professor of chemistry from 1863 until his death in 1902, and then Frank Kedzie succeeded him as professor of chemistry. And so if anybody ever knew Michigan Agricultural College, it was Frank Kedzie. Well, he wrote to a man named Elwood C. Perishall, who was at the South Dakota Agricultural College in October of 1917. And Kedzie, in this quote, it's about seven lines, captured in many ways the essence of the first 60 years of Michigan Agricultural College. I read Frank Kedzie's words. "Unconsciously, this college has been preparing for years for this war. Its training of the men of Michigan who came to us as four-year and short course students has been to make them more efficient, as are our young women trained for efficiency. It is through them, as they are scattered throughout the state, that the college is enabled to contribute a wonderful, stimulating influence favorable to the progress of the war." It's a marvelous quote. It's a marvelous recognition of what this college was striving to do. And the war experience and the college's contribution to the war experience and the contribution made by the alumni and the faculty of this institution really, in my opinion, helped to bond this college to the state in a way that had never happened before. Controversies over engineering I don't think ever appeared again, at least not the kind of intensity that we had. This really showed that what was happening here was meaningful and would be meaningful in the lives of the people in a way that no one had really anticipated. To conclude my remarks tonight, I want to talk a little bit about Ray Stannard Baker. Baker Hall is named after him, and it's somewhat unfortunate that Ray Stannard Baker on this campus does not get more attention, because I think he is one of the real giants of this institution. He graduated from here in 1889. He was born in Lansing, but he grew up in St. Croix County in northwest Wisconsin and found his way back here and attended college and graduated in 1889. Baker married Jessie Beale, the daughter of W.J. Beale and Hannah Proud Beale. And so throughout the rest of Beale's life until Beale's death, Baker and Beale would always be connected. But Ray Stannard Baker was one of these men who was a terrific writer. He was one of the muckrakers. He wrote with Lincoln Steffens and Ida Tarbell and McClure's Magazine, was a very good researcher and a very insightful critic of what was going on in American society, very critical of the industrial giants, very critical of race relations and labor relations in the country. Was a guy who I really, is. The more I learned about him, the more I wanted to learn about him. And unfortunately, I had to do more than just do Baker. But he was the confidant of three presidents, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, in Woodrow Wilson. In fact, the Wilsons thought so highly of him that they gave him special access to the Wilson papers, and Baker produced an 8-volume work on Woodrow Wilson's life, for which he won the Pulitzer Prize in 1940 for the last 2 volumes. Baker wrote published in 1945, the year before his death, The American Chronicle. It's really an autobiography, and if you ever want a good read, check out The American Chronicle. I couldn't put it down. And because he has so much common sense, and he's so insightful. And one of the things that he comments on is democracy. And as I argue in the book, I think that Michigan Agricultural College played a very important role in expanding democracy in America, not just in Michigan, in America, in the world, because of all the numbers of people who've gone out from it. I read from the introduction to the book. Quote, in 1945, reflecting upon his long life in the small town of Amherst, Massachusetts, Ray Stannard Baker, class of 89, captured the essence of MAC's democratic ideal when he wrote in his autobiography, quote, but it is not enough to live in a country town. One must also live with it. Little towns are shy. They are not easily taken by assault. Their acceptances are often slow, but they are genuine. Nothing much is said about democracy, but we manage to get a good deal of it into our common affairs. We somehow know that the core of democracy lies not in being able to make something out of the town, but of contributing something to the town, end quote. Baker's life was characterized by contributing something to the world. He and his fellow students learned at Michigan Agricultural College that democracy was more dependent upon what they gave to their community than upon what they received from it. A healthy democracy thrives when people actively participate in community affairs rather than sit by passively and absorb its benefits. And I think that ultimately is one of the keys to the success of this institution, is that it has trained literally tens of thousands of men and women to go out into the world and to serve the world in all kinds of capacities and in some of the most ordinary ways and the most basic ways where people live their everyday lives. Thank you. Any of you have any questions, or you'd be happy to.
How do you as a historian decide how much context you need to pull into the book? How much in the politics, economics, other states?
Yeah.
How do you cut that off?
Well, that's a challenge because it's limitless. And when I was doing this book, I determined and discovered when I got into the archives that I wanted to tell the story from the institution inside out. In other words, that this was going to be, because the way the history was unfolding, there were such strong leaders, you know, in terms of the people like Beale and Kedzie and Cook and T.C. Abbott and Fisk and students, their attitudes, things really, really revealed to me that the land grant philosophy was shaped by them, not by the forces outside. And that I was going to focus on this land grant philosophy. That was to be the focus. And so that helps then to put some limits as to what the intellectual context is, what the physical context is. And of course, the big thing that's going on in the United States at this time is the movement from a society that is primarily rooted in agriculture to an industrialized and urbanized society. That help? Right.
So, kind of comparison of how it turns out when you do it the other way?
Well,
in
that's
terms of how extension works and the state and all that?
Yeah, well, each state is different. I mean, there's no two of these colleges, no two college universities are alike. And in Wisconsin and Minnesota were states where the university was already established, and it was decided that the land grant or the agricultural school would be part of the state university. I think that one of the things that happened in some of these schools was that the agricultural college really took them longer to get it really going. That's not going to be true all the way across the board. I think that, you know, obviously in Wisconsin, you don't have the kind of rivalry you have here between Michigan and Michigan Agricultural College. But one of the, when I found that actually after the college was once really firmly established here by about 1869, University of Michigan was a very supportive of what was going on here. In some ways, because what was going on here really was complementing what was going on in Ann Arbor rather than being in conflict with it. My sense is that probably the extension services run somewhat similar, in part because there's also the United States Department of Agriculture is involved in it, and so you have, you know, and this is again one of the real geniuses of the Morrill Act and the cooperative extension was it linked together the federal government as well as the states and the agricultural colleges, and so I think I didn't go to the University of Wisconsin in Madison, so I don't know that institution all that well. But in growing up, that was at that time was always usually the U, and the U meant Madison. Today there's, I went UWM, I said, well, Milwaukee and other institutions as well. But I think that in Michigan, having two institutions has been a real benefit for the state because we now have two large, you know, state universities where it might only have one. And I think it allowed what was going on here to develop in a way that I don't think was as true in places like Wisconsin. In fact, you find that many of the early graduates here played a very prominent role in other land-grant institutions, particularly if you go places, Purdue, Iowa State, Nebraska, Mississippi, Texas, Arizona, Oregon, Colorado, all those states where there are the land-grant schools, you will find MAC people being very important in the early get-up. In fact, even University of Wisconsin, a guy named Daniel, I think his first name was William, who graduated here, think about the class of 1864 maybe, was very important in developing the chemistry department at the University of Wisconsin. Did that help? Yeah. Okay. Any other questions?
How come there are so many international students? How are they attracted?
Well, you had students wanting to come here, particularly to this institution, to study agriculture.
How would they hear about it?
yeah, that's a good question. You know, Turkey, yeah. Japan. Well, the Japanese were quite interested in developing agricultural education and some Western education, bringing Western education. So Japan was fairly early in students here and students in other universities as well. I say they came here primarily for agriculture and it had a reputation. This was a good place to study agriculture. I don't think of any of the early international students, and I'm sure as I say there weren't any, there will be one or two, who got degrees in mechanical, in the mechanical program. They were all agriculture. So, some of them may have learned about the American universities through missionaries. Foreign missionaries.
But there were never missionaries here. No, but
missionaries who had, I mean, yeah. but actually you will find there are some graduates here who did go out on the mission field. But that's a good question. I don't really have as good an answer as I would like to have for that.
That seems awfully fast.
Yeah.
Your other book,
they probably were not. They were not granting lands that were reserved to Indians. I mean, these were lands that were not necessarily in the state, as I understand, where, you know.
Like this campus, for example.
Right.
Do you know if there were Native Americans living on this land?
Well, this campus was not part of land grant. In other words, the land grant refers to lands that were federal lands that were set aside for the purposes of states could choose that would be sold. And so, but they weren't the lands where the college itself was placed. And so these lands, actually, when this, and remember, Michigan is before the Land Grant Act. So Michigan Agriculture College is established before the Morrill Act is passed. There actually still were Native Americans living in the region. But this property was purchased, I think it was about 567 acres or something, because it was within 10 miles of the state capital, which it had to be, and it was affordable. And so it was basically here were mosquitoes and trees and swamp, and a lot of clearing had to be done. So I don't think that was probably an issue, whether they were Indian lands or not.
So is the disappearance of the human ecology section of MSU an abandonment of that early philosophy?
Well, unfortunately, I don't know enough about that. But first, I will say is when I began thinking about doing this book and I talked to people about it, it's amazing how many people say, we got to go talk to so-and-so about their department or what have you. And I decided that I didn't want to know about the university in 2000 because it's very hard to envision this place as a swamp and as a wilderness. And yet that's important to try to see as the physical development reflects the intellectual development and the growth of the college. And so I made a deliberately decided not to try to understand the University of 2000 and wind up trying to telescope back. So I don't know enough about your question to answer it because I don't know what's happened to what human ecology teaches. I would say this, though, that the human ecology or home economics or domestic arts and domestic sciences, you push the nomenclature back in time, really was and became a very important part of what the land grant philosophy was. I mean, this was a training of women to work with and to teach girls and other women how to do things in the home, and not only to teach them how to do it, but how to teach others as well. And just as the agricultural course was rooted in a strong scientific course load as well as liberal courses, the women took the same, were educated in the same way. They too took science, and they too took the liberal arts. So I can't really answer your question, Reed, because I don't know enough. But the answer to the question really is what's happened to what what they taught. Okay, thank you very much. Enjoyed this. Good. And if anybody wants any books, here we are.